Hello, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun for March 4th, 2025. I'm Flagstaff volunteer reader Julia. Front page articles include County Updated on Wildfire Preparations, NWS Details City's Fire Season Forecast, and City Mole's Transfer of Housing Voucher Program. County Updated on Wildfire Preparations. Hearing updates from the National Weather Service, Arizona Public Service, and staff from Coconino County Emergency Management and the Coconino County Sheriff's Office, the Coconino County Board of Supervisors took a look at the area's readiness for the upcoming fire season. The presentation at the end of the board's Tuesday, February 25th meeting provided an overview of the current environmental conditions, mitigation efforts from APS, and other details on the county's preparations for possible evacuations. Led by Tim Carter, Coconino County's Interim Director of Emergency Management, the presentation spanned nearly 2 hours as the county looked to get ahead of what could be a significant wildland fire season. It's a very real hazard that we face here in the county with our wildfire season coming up, Carter said to the board. Unfortunately, what we know is that wildfire is no longer a season, it is year-round. Noting that the 6-person Department of Emergency Management can't manage county wildfire preparedness on its own, Carter said the department's partnerships with federal, state, and local jurisdictions, as well as private entities, lead to year-round efforts by everyone involved. Though representatives from the U.S. Forest Service were not able to attend the presentation, District 1 Supervisor and Board Vice Chair Petrus Horstman said the county meets with the agency monthly and has been in ongoing communication as they partner on fire mitigation and preparedness. While reminding the public that the county does not control fire restrictions for national forest land, and that the county specifically only makes decisions for the unincorporated lands of Coconino County, Carter said conversations on restrictions begin with coordination calls between all of our regional, federal, state, and local partners, based on NWS reports detailing the environmental conditions in the forecast. Although those conversations typically begin near the end of March or the start of April, conditions throughout the region led to them starting up those talks in the middle of February. APS mitigation. Detailing the fire mitigation plan that has been in development for a decade, APS Fire Mitigation Manager Wade Ward highlighted efforts that have been made over the years to assist with fire prevention, monitoring fires as they begin, and alleviating the impact as fires burn. The generation, transmission, and distribution of electricity is inherently dangerous, but I think we would all agree that the system we do have is incredibly safe, Ward said. The ability to walk under a power line and to use the electricity that we do in our homes is very safe and efficient, but we have to take further steps given the conditions that we have. After highlighting that APS has been adding non-expulsion fuses in elevated fire conditions and mesh around utility poles to keep them from burning in fires, Ward specifically focused on the company's expansion of its public safety power shutoff and the data collection that goes into the decision-making process. Expanding its footprint of remote automatic weather stations to more than 100 located on its utility poles across the state by May 1st, APS will also have around 100 pan-tilt zoom cameras to monitor weather and oncoming fire. Another 13 artificial intelligence cameras are also spread around the state at high-level positions to identify smoke in the area. According to Ward, one of the smoke detection cameras is located on Mount Eldon, another in Munns Park, and one at the Sedona Airport, with the expectation of 15 more to be added this year, including in Williams. Access to the information provided by the cameras is available to multiple federal, state, and local agencies in an effort to detect fires as early as possible. Ward said they have been able to pick up fires from a single camera more than 25 miles away, and that APS has the capability to move the camera and zoom to 30 times. In some areas, cameras may overlap in view, which allows them to triangulate the fire and provide a latitude and longitude. I tell them in the onboarding process that you're not going to get a bill after a year that says you viewed it 1,000 times, Ward said. This is a partnership from APS to our stakeholders to better detect these fires early on. Most notable in the presentation by APS is the expansion of the PSPS system. It's not something that we want to do, Ward said. We do understand that that's an inconvenience, but we also understand there are conditions that we are presented with in our environment that, with the potential for extreme conditions, particularly wind and low relative humidity, makes sense to have this tool in our toolbox. Intending to prevent power lines or electrical systems from starting a wildfire during extreme fire conditions, the PSPS system is planned to be used in a very limited capacity in high fire risk areas. In the most ideal situation, Ward said, forecasts would allow for APS to inform customers 4 days ahead of time the intention to shut down power. But he recognized that there may be times when something comes up more suddenly, and we're not going to take the risk of not doing it just because we don't have 4 days. Janet Dean, Senior Public Affairs Manager for the Northeast Division of APS, detailed the areas that could be impacted. When the program began last year, Dean said, it started small with 13 feeder lines in areas beyond Flagstaff, such as the Lake Mary area, Mormon Lake, and Fort Valley. An expansion to 65 feeder lines in northern Arizona could bring impacts to areas within the city of Flagstaff, with Mars Hill and Mount Eldon noted as areas of concern. We are trying to be as surgical and as precise as we can so that we turn off power where we have safety concerns, and we try to limit who is impacted based on those safety concerns, Dean said. But the way our lines run, sometimes there will be impacts for customers who may not be right in the area of concern. Dean added that a more interactive map of the areas that could be further impacted this summer will soon be added to the APS website, allowing for customers to see specific properties and search the addresses that will be impacted, and mailing to customers on lines that might see PSPS impacts. County preparedness. County staff closed for the presentation by offering details on what the community can do to prepare for the fire season now, where to check for fire restrictions in the multitude of jurisdictions across the county, and how assistance may be available for those who could be impacted by power outages or evacuations. Most importantly, Carter wanted to convey to the public that people should be signed up for the county's notification system, which will assist APS with informing the public of potential shutoffs. The notification system will also allow for members of the public to detail to the county that they would be in specific need of power for medical devices, or if they are unable to cool their homes in the summer without electricity, allowing them to be directed to locations that can provide assistance. For those in the county's notification system, they would receive targeted alerts based on their address regarding possible outages, evacuation plans, or where shelters may be open. As a part of the county's evacuation zone plan, Carter encouraged county residents to become familiar with the name of their zones, as the emergency notifications will rely less on the coordinates of streets or Forest Service roads and instead on the map available at the county's emergency management page. Similarly, details on restrictions for any of the lands within Coconino County's boundaries, even those not governed by the county itself, can be found at coconino.az.gov/fire-restrictions. Due to the close proximity of different jurisdictions all throughout the county, Carter said most agencies try to begin restrictions in a coordinated manner in order to make it less confusing for law enforcement and the communities. Reinforcing the county's Ready, Set, Go system, Carter said residents should remember that there could be just minutes between when a set alert is sent out and when a go order follows for the same area. For me, set stage means you take your stuff that you are going to evacuate with, you take it out of the hall closet and put it by the front door or put it in the car, Carter said, because when we issue the go notice, it is time to go. It's not time to start packing then. Carter also explained that residents should consider preparing an evacuation kit and that the county is working with the City of Flagstaff's Sustainability Office, Resilience Hubs in the city, the Market of Dreams, and the Murdoch Center in order to provide evacuation kits through grants. Coconino County Sheriff Brett Axland expanded on the county's evacuation plans, explaining his office takes direction from the county's firefighting partners as they're going to be the experts in how a fire acts, where it goes, how fast it goes. Echoing Carter's point that evacuation orders from set to go can change within minutes, Axland said the county learned more about its capabilities in covering an extended evacuation area during the tunnel fire. Needing to call in additional sheriff's deputies from Mojave, Navajo, and Yavapai counties, Axland said additional county departments also assisted with shutting down roads. Though a person cannot be arrested for choosing to stay in an area under an evacuation order, they cannot be allowed back until the order is lifted if they decide to evacuate initially. Axland said the sheriff's office also works with the county's fire partners in deciding when to allow residents to return, adding that once the public is back in their homes, they will not leave again should a re-entry order be rescinded. As fire experts work to ensure there's a zero chance of danger to communities, Axland said, the office is aware of people's insistence in returning as soon as possible. We have to realize that our folks need to get back into their homes, so we have to take that into consideration when we allow reentry, Axland said. There's been several times where we've had to do a lot of quick talking with our fire partners to be able to agree that it is safe enough to let our folks back in. The complete presentation can be found on the Coconino County YouTube page. And that was the article, County Updated on Wildfire Preparations. The next article is NWS Details City's Fire Season Forecast. As the city starts March nearly 5 feet behind the normal snowfall for the season, Flagstaff's long-range forecast doesn't show much upcoming relief from the dry conditions. Taking a look back on the winter's lack of snow or significant precipitation, as well as looking ahead to the temperatures and precipitation expected from March to June, meteorologist in charge Brian Kilmovsky and warning coordinator meteorologist Megan Taylor from the National Weather Service office in Belmont detailed the current drought conditions in northern Arizona to the Coconino County Board of Supervisors during its February 25th meeting. It's wonderful to be outside, but it serves as a sobering reminder of the dry winter that we've had, Kirumovsky said. It's been one of the driest winters we've had, and we have very good reason to be concerned about our upcoming fire season. As of February 26th, Flagstaff remained 56.5 inches below normal for snowfall this season with just 11.2 inches so far, and the city is 4.10 inches below normal for precipitation since October 1st. Those totals have led to severe or extreme drought conditions around Flagstaff as of February 20th's data. with the region previously experiencing moderate drought conditions at this time a year ago. Clearly worsening drought conditions, much of Coconino County is experiencing severe to extreme drought conditions, Taylor said. Even just in the last 4 weeks, drought conditions have worsened by one or even two categories. Taylor shared a look back at the percentage of normal precipitation over the past 90 days, with nearly all of Arizona coming in well below normal, with somewhere between 0 to 25% of the normal precipitation. While portions of Coconino County shifted into the 25 to 50% range following the storm on February 13th and 14th, the snowpack across the county is significantly diminished compared to the normal measurements. Specifically, the snow water equivalent of the measured snowpack locations in the area were well below 50% of the median. The snow water equivalent refers to the depth of liquid water that would occur if the snowpack were to completely melt, essentially serving as a measurement of the total amount of water contained in the snowpack at a given time. Many of the existing snowpack locations measured at or below an inch, with the measurement at White Horse Lake and Heber, the lowest snowpack on record, which stretches back about 40 years. Fort Valley's snow water equivalent measured at 0% of the median. Mormon Mountain was at 2%, and it was just 16% at the measurement location south of Camp Navajo and southwest of Flagstaff. Looking ahead to March and the traditional fire season between April and June, the Climate Prediction Center shows much of the same for the northern Arizona region and the state overall. For March, there's a 33% to 50% chance of higher than normal temperatures and a 33 to 50% chance of lower than normal precipitation. The odds for continued dry conditions increase in the outlook for fire season, with a 40% to 50% chance of below normal precipitation and a 40% to 60% chance of above normal temperatures. Putting all these pieces together, this leads to what the drought is going to look like, Taylor said. We are expecting drought to persist across all of northern Arizona through the spring months. While northern Arizona's outlook on fire potential remains normal through March, the outlook shifts the White Mountains area above normal for April and the entire eastern half of Arizona above normal for May, including the Mogollon Rim. Our message here is that if the dry conditions persist into the spring, there is potential for an extended and significant wildfire season, Taylor said. The complete presentation can be found on the Coconino County YouTube page. And that was the article, NWS Details City's Fire Season Forecast. The next article is City MOLS Transfer of Housing Voucher Program. The City of Flagstaff is considering a transfer of the Housing Choice Voucher Program from Williams, noting that it would add 50 housing vouchers and a new service area to Flagstaff's existing voucher program. City Housing Director Sarah Darr explained the details of the potential transfer to Flagstaff City Council at a work session on Tuesday, February 25th, and had previously presented it to the City Housing Authority. The item will be brought before both groups again in March for new approval. The move would be a voluntary transfer that was first suggested by the City of Williams in May 2024, and include the entirety of Williams' HCV program, all current voucher holders in Williams would be able to continue under their current leases, with Darr saying the only impact would be the city staff they work with. This isn't a takeover the world effort, she said. This is responding to a request from our oversight agency and funding agency of HUD, and also our neighboring community of Williams. We seriously considered this opportunity because it will increase the number of resources available in our community to serve low-income households with rental assistance. Program transfer. If the transfer is approved, the change will go into effect July 1st. If it does not go through, the Williams Housing Vouchers, according to DAR, will be moved to HUD, leaving Northern Arizona. Program transfers are uncommon, she said, and require approval from both agencies involved as well as the state and national level of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which also requires protection for the current voucher holders when a program is transferred. The service areas for Flagstaff and Williams would become a single service area, with voucher holders able to lease units in either location. Flagstaff's current service area covers zip codes 86001 to 86005, while Williams area is within its city limits. This will add a total of 50 vouchers to Flagstaff's current total, and current voucher holders in Williams will continue their involvement in the program unchanged. According to DAR, the city housing hasn't been able to determine which households are on the Williams wait list and confirm its continued interest in participation. The combined voucher program would also have the funding allocated to both programs, which would add around $60,000 a year to Flagstaff's current total. The change would allow hiring an additional staff member to help administer the program. This adds vouchers we can issue to people on our waiting list and increased service area for voucher holders to lease in, DAR said. It would preserve housing resources in the community and add to our immediately local ones as well. It will increase our service area but not require daily staff presence. DAR added, any significant risk to us will be mitigated, or we do not have to accept the transfer. Flagstaff and Williams will be hosting a meeting with current voucher holders and landlords in Williams to discuss the transfer and answer questions. Williams Voucher Program. Reasons the City of Williams cited in asking for this transfer included a decrease in available rental units as well as a lack of staffing. DAR estimated that there are 250 short-term rentals in Williams, which is more than 15% of the city's housing stock. The total budget allocation for the Williams voucher program is around $60,000, though DAR said it has been at 50% or lower utilization for the last few years. She estimates that between 18 and 22 vouchers are currently in use in Williams. This is based on data from April 2024. Because of a lack of program staff, currently no one is employed to administer the Williams program. It's not enough when you're underutilized and you have limited housing stock in order to run a program of this relatively small size, DAR said, noting that Flagstaff's larger size gives it a greater margin of error if, for example, multiple voucher holders unexpectedly leave the program. Flagstaff's Voucher Program. The Housing Choice Voucher Program comes from HUD and is operated by state and local housing agencies. Most vouchers are reserved for households making 30% or less of the area median income, and households earning 80% or less of the AMI are eligible for the remainder. A household using a voucher pays 30% of its income toward rent, with the local housing authority paying the remainder. Both payments are made directly to the landlord. To be eligible, the units must pass an inspection and be priced reasonably, based on the area's fair market rent. Flagstaff currently has more than 530 housing vouchers. A total of 342 are Section 8 vouchers, determined by income, and the rest are special purpose vouchers with additional eligibility requirements. These are intended to serve specific groups, such as veterans, those with a disability, serious mental illness, and youth aging out of foster care, among others. Dar noted that the 530 vouchers represent the total of Flagstaff households, rather than individuals served by the program. A total of 121 landlords participate in the program, and in 2024, an average of $599,927 a month was paid to landlords through Flagstaff's HCV program. Dar described utilization as a balance between funding available to the housing authority for the program and vouchers being used, which changes with the situations of voucher-holding households. Flagstaff has been operating at a 98% or higher utilization rate for the past 15 years, she said, compared to a target of 95%. The number of days for most tenants between receiving a voucher and beginning to use it on their lease, known as issuance to move in, was most commonly between 30 and 60 days. This was the case for 40% of voucher holders, or 60 and 90 days. Another 18% had fewer than 30 days between issuance and move-in, and between 10% and 15% were able to use their vouchers in the place they were already renting. Search times are typically longer, issuance to move in is typically longer in high-cost areas. And we are a high-cost area, she said. Other high-cost areas in the nation averaged only 29% leased at 60 days. We're at 58%. They increased to 45% leased at 90 days, and we're at 96% moved in at the 90-day mark. Flagstaff's voucher success rate is 70%, compared to 60% across the U.S., and its turnover rate is 11%. Flagstaff currently has open waitlists for all of its voucher programs, with an approximate wait time of at least 18 to 36 months. The national average, according to Dar, is 30 months, or 2.5 years. A total of 2,506 households are on the waiting list, according to Dar's presentation, 890 of which said they lived or worked in the Flagstaff service area. A total of 712 units in multifamily new construction were completed in Flagstaff in 2024. 112 of which are designated affordable units. Another 564 are currently under construction, with 243 set to be affordable. 220 of those, she noted, are in a project set to finish by the end of this year. Between January 2022 and the present, Dar added 1,917 other units and multifamily projects were approved for development. She noted that these totals do not include single-family construction. A recording of the Flagstaff City Council work session is available at youtube.com/@FlagstaffCityGovernment with Dar's presentation beginning about 3 hours and 15 minutes into the February 25th meeting. And that was the article, City Moles Transfer of Housing Voucher Program. You're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flagstaff Studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand. From our website, choose Broadcast Info and Audio, then On Demand. The next article is CCSO deputies arrest 3 for drug trafficking, 1 suspect at large. The Coconino County Sheriff's K-9 unit seized heroin, cocaine, and other unidentified narcotics in traffic stops conducted this weekend east of Flagstaff. Deputies arrested three suspects, but one fled on foot from officers and has not been located since. Just after 7 a.m. on Friday, February 28th, the canine unit stopped a vehicle for a traffic violation on Interstate 40 near the Cosnino Road exit. Upon searching the vehicle, the deputy discovered 1.12 pounds of suspected heroin and 27.6 grams of crack cocaine. The driver of that vehicle, who CCSO identified as Misael Lopez Cortaza, 37, was booked into the Coconino County Detention Facility on a charge of transporting narcotic drugs for sale, a Class 2 felony. Jail records show that Cortaza was released the next day after posting bond. On Sunday, March 2nd, the canine unit stopped another vehicle along the same stretch of I-40 near Cosnino, shortly before 11 a.m. During this traffic stop, deputies found unspecified suspected illegal substances in the vehicle, according to a CCSO press release. A picture of canine Dex, released by the office, shows two plastic bags of small circular blue pills, a common shape and color for counterfeit oxycodone tablets, containing fentanyl. Deputies took two subjects into custody, but one suspect fled on foot into the wooded area south of the interstate. CCSO identified the man who fled as Brian Mercado Campos, 24, a Hispanic man with short facial hair wearing blue jeans, a red shirt, a light black jacket, and black shoes resembling Vans. CCSO stated that deputies and officers from other agencies searched the area for several hours, but did not locate Campos. The other two suspects from the March 2nd stop, identified by CCSO as Carlos Boyorquez, Chiadid Verduzco, 25, were both booked into the county jail on charges of transporting narcotic drugs for sale. As of Monday, Campos was still at large. CCSO asks anyone with information on his whereabouts to contact their office at 928-774-4523 or call 911. And that was the article, CCSO deputies arrest three for drug trafficking, one suspect at large. The next article is Coconino County announces 2025 Teacher of the Year finalists. Cheryl Mango Page, the Coconino County Superintendent of Schools, announced the finalists for Coconino County Teacher of the Year and Coconino County Rookie Teacher of the Year awards. The winners of the awards will be announced during the 12th Annual Coconino County Teacher of the Year Awards, scheduled for 5 p.m. on Thursday, April 17th, at the High Country Conference Center in Flagstaff. The three finalists for Teacher of the Year include Joy Bruner from De Miguel Elementary School, Don Quamahong-Newa from Liup Elementary School, and Francie Salarte Soto from Coconino High School. For Rookie Teacher of the Year, the finalists include Leslie Littlefield from Knowles Elementary School, Christy Marshall from Thomas Elementary School, and Ella Stoll from Coconino High School. Coconino County Teacher of the Year is a county-wide celebration recognizing the dedication, innovation, and excellence of state-accredited pre-K through 12th grade educators. A total of 24 teachers were nominated for Teacher of the Year, while five educators were nominated for Rookie Teacher of the Year. At the awards ceremony, the Coconino County Teacher of the Year, Coconino County Rookie Teacher of the Year, and the Ambassadors for Excellence will be acknowledged. Each finalist will be awarded cash prizes, automatic nomination for the Arizona Teacher of the Year Award, and various other accolades. The Coconino County Teacher of the Year will also be presented with a one-year leased vehicle provided by Flagstaff Findlay Toyota. Additionally, the event will feature the presentation of the Lifetime Achievement Award, an honor from the Superintendent of Schools as a surprise announcement during the ceremony. Lifetime Achievement recipients will be recognized for their profound contributions to education. And that was the article, Coconino County Announces 2025 Teacher of the Year Finalists. The next article is Space Available in Flagstaff Community Gardens. Applications are open now for plots in the City of Flagstaff's Community Gardens and will remain open until March 31st or all spaces are claimed. Returning gardeners will be given priority to renew their plots. New applicants who do not have access to growing space at home or who qualify for SNAP benefits will be given priority for remaining available plots. Any plots left will be filled on a first-come, first-served basis, and aspiring new gardeners are encouraged to apply early. Plots are available at the Bonito Community Garden on West Elm Avenue, the Hal Jensen Community Garden on North Isabel Street, and the historic Southside Community Garden on South O'Leary Street. The annual registration fee for a plot is $65, but full or half scholarships are available for gardeners who express a need in their application. Registration fees fund water expenses, infrastructure improvements, and resources for gardeners. The application form is available at flagstaff.az.gov/gardens. For any related questions, please email gardens@flagstaffaz.gov or call 928-213-2153. And that was the article, Space Available in Flagstaff Community Gardens. The next article is Governor Names Neil Sherman to Coconino County Judgeship. Flagstaff attorney Neil E. Sherman will be the newest judge on the Coconino County Superior Court. Governor Katie Hobbs recently announced Sherman's appointment to the court. When reached for comment, Sherman said he was overwhelmed and humbled by the appointment. He praised the current Superior Court judges, whom he said would be great colleagues to work with. Sherman was one of three nominees for the vacancy created by Judge Kathleen B. Nichols' retirement. The others were Charles W. Doty, senior attorney for the nonprofit DNA People's Legal Services, and Marianne E. Sullivan, senior assistant attorney for the City of Flagstaff. Sherman received a bachelor's degree from Arizona State University in 2010 and his law degree from the Thomas M. Cooley School of Law in 2014. Prior to becoming an attorney, he worked as a sign language interpreter. Sherman spent 2 years with the Arizona Attorney General's office and a brief stint in the City of Flagstaff Prosecutor's Office before co-founding the firm Antle and Sherman, PC, where he specialized in family law. In her announcement, Hobbs said, "Neil Sherman has demonstrated a commitment to working collaboratively on behalf of Arizona children and families throughout his legal career. I am proud to appoint him to the Coconino County Superior Court, where his hard work and deep expertise in family law will be an asset to the people of Coconino County and Arizona for years to come." Sherman said he will need some time to wind down his involvement in his law practice, but hopes to step into his new role by April. "I know that having an empty division is not good, so I'm working to get ready as soon as I can," he said. Asked about his hopes for the future, Sherman said, "I am hopeful that people will feel heard. Obviously, a judge isn't going to agree with everyone all of the time. But I think that people come to court wanting to be heard, and they have a right to be heard. I hope that people feel like they're leaving with a sense of justice, and they feel like the court system is working. Not everybody gets what they want out of a contested proceeding," he noted. I think the best that we can offer is a fair shot for everyone to have a chance to be heard and present their side of the story, and have a fair and impartial decision that is made expeditiously so the parties can move on with their lives. And that was the article, Governor Names Neil Sherman to Coconino County Judgeship. The next article is Track Sweeps Big Sky Titles Once Again. For the fifth straight season, the Northern Arizona men's and women's track and field teams claimed Big Sky Conference Indoor Championship meet titles on Saturday at the Walk-Up Sky Dome. The men defended their home track with their 13th straight indoor title with 188 points, besting the Montana State Bobcats, who placed second with 148 points. The women defended for the fifth straight year with 205 points, topping the Bobcats, who took second with 132.5 points. Northern Arizona's Drew Bosley was named the meet's most valuable athlete, along with Lumberjacks teammate Lene Perry on the women's side. Additionally, Perry won Most Outstanding Performer for her conference record in the 400 meters. Kiki Vaughn claimed Freshman of the Year on the women's side. Northern Arizona won 11 Big Sky individual titles and 22 All Big Sky honors total on Saturday. It also set four all-time records, including two conference records in the women's 4x400-meter relay and the women's 400-meter. Over the weekend, the Lumberjacks claimed 16 Big Sky titles. Perry had a historical performance in the 400-meter with a personal best of 52.27, which broke the school and Big Sky all-time record. Kyra Ray saved her best 400-meter for last this season, placing second with a personal best ranking second all-time behind Perry. Also picking up points for the Lumberjacks in the women's 400-meter was Maggie Congdon, who placed fifth in 53.73, setting a personal best for the second straight race. Perry had quite the day as she won the 200-meter in 23.54 for a new PR, which ranks second all-time. Ray finished sixth in the event, picking up 3 points for Northern Arizona after running 24.28. Saturday started strong with a Lumberjack sweep in the men's mile. Colin Solomon led the way in 4 minutes and 5.18 seconds, and he was followed by Bosley, who ran a season best 4 minutes and 5.71 seconds. David Mullerkey joined them on the podium after crossing the line in 4 minutes and 6.37 seconds. Ford Washburn also earned points in the event. Solomon also won the 800-meter for the second straight season in 1 minute 51.2 seconds. Also earning points in the event were Washburn and Kang Nyoak. The night after winning the mile, Bosley won the 3,000-meter in 8 minutes and 17.03 seconds. Mullerkey placed second, crossing the line in 8 minutes and 23.63 seconds. Eric LaRoe just missed the podium, finishing fourth in 8 minutes and 25.41 seconds. Also picking up points were Santiago Prosser, Aiden Puffer, and Kale Grotenhuy. In the women's mile, the Lumberjacks dominated by taking every point available. Congdon won the gold in 4 minutes and 50.73 seconds, and Elise Stearns and Carrie Baloga raced to all conference honors. Also picking up points were Alexandra Carlson, Ava Mitchell, Haley Burns, Agnes McTee, and Emma Stesman. Carlson and Stearns also earned all Big Sky honors in the 800 meter, with Carlson taking the gold in 2 minutes and 9.14 seconds. Stearns placed third in 2 minutes and 10.84 seconds, and sandwiched in the middle was Vaughn, who earned her first All Big Sky honor, placing second in 2 minutes and 10.84 seconds. Beloga led a whole pack of Lumberjacks in the women's 3,000 meter, taking the crown in 9 minutes, 29.27 seconds. She edged Burns, who came in at 9 minutes, 29 and 27 seconds. The only other competitor to break up the Lumberjacks at the top was Montana State, which placed third. After that, Northern Arizona finished 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 10th. The others who earned points in the event were Anna Fenske, Mitchell, Allie Upshaw, Maisie Grice, and Alexis Kipp. Northern Arizona picked up a pair of titles in the men's and women's 4x400 meters. The men's team made up of Joshua Anderson, Josiah Johnson, Tyson Givens, and Salmon clocked 3 minutes and 12.13 seconds. On the women's side, Riley Congdon, Taylor Jacobs, and Perry set an all-time Big Sky record and Northern Arizona program record in 3 minutes 35.48 seconds. Sydney Watkins, in her first ever Big Sky Championships, placed third overall to earn all Big Sky honors in the 60-meter hurdles with a time of 8.5. In the field events, Desmond Lott won the shot put for Northern Arizona after winning the weight throw with a meet record the night before. He tossed 18.43 meters for a new personal best. Also earning all-conference honors was Sir Butler in the triple jump, who placed second after leaping 14.98 meters. The Lumberjacks performed strong in the 60-meter hurdle finals, led by Givens, who was fourth in 8.01. Johnson and Sean Martin also picked up points for Northern Arizona. Johnson also competed in the 400 meter, in which he placed 7th with a time of 48.21. Anderson led to the Lumberjacks in the 400 meters, placing 6th with a personal best of 47.81. A select number of Lumberjacks will await selections for the NCAA Division I Championships set for March 14th to 15th in Virginia Beach. And that was the article, Track Sweeps Big Sky Titles Once Again. The next column is Change is in the Hair for Longtime Client. Dear Abby, I have been seeing a hairstylist for a decade. During the last couple of years, I don't feel I've gotten the service I deserve. I go in for a trim about every 2 months. She is extremely busy and sometimes delegates green hairstylists to wash and blow dry my hair. I appreciate that she gives new hairstylists a chance to get experience, but last time two different people worked on my hair in addition to her, and it took an hour and a half for a simple trim. On top of that, she charged me an extra $10. I like to tip everyone properly. Sometimes she's a little late for appointments. The last time I asked for a different hairstyle, she gave pushback because I wouldn't take care of it. I'm ready to move on to someone new and a new hairstyle. What is the proper way to break up with your hairstylist? I would like to do it in person, but it could be awkward, and she could get angry. Should I give an extra tip? Hairy Situation in California. Dear Hairy Situation, you are not this stylist's friend. You are her client. You have every right to change stylists, and you shouldn't feel guilty for doing so. If you feel you must give her a reason, tell her the truth on the phone or in person. You are within your rights to make a change, if you wish. It shouldn't create ill feelings, and you don't have to give her a farewell tip. Dear Abby, I'm a single parent, and my kid's grandfather has offered to watch them at his house once a week. I would love to take him up on it because it would help me keep up with all of my responsibilities. But I hesitate because he wasn't an involved father, so he has no parenting experience. For example, he struggles with conflict management between the kids. He has no sense. I do not trust he knows what or when to feed the kids. Also, his house is a complete mess. He never throws anything away. My kids enjoy spending time with him, and we don't have much family, so I'd like to foster their relationships. How do I maximize the good and minimize the bad of their visits? How do I support him doing the best by my children without me being overbearing? Signed, Mom with Help. Dear Mom, some of the issues you raise can be resolved by simply talking to your father-in-law and telling him how you resolve conflicts between the kids, what you want them fed, and when. A messy house is different from one that could have a negative impact upon their health. How bad is it? Does the place pose a danger to your children? Is it possible that he could babysit at your house rather than his? Regarding his temper, however, are you absolutely sure he won't abuse your children if he loses it? If the answer to that question is no, then babysitting cannot be allowed. And that was the Dear Abby advice column. The next article is Measure Would Protect Power Companies from Wildfire Lawsuits. The Arizona House on Tuesday approved a slightly watered-down measure backed by power companies that will give them major new protections from lawsuits they face for wildfires that their equipment sparks. The 35-25 vote approving the bill came a day after opponents of this sweeping liability shield sought by power providers who are worried that homeowners would be left holding the bag amended it to restore the ability of homeowners and others to band together to file class action lawsuits if they suffer losses. But the House refused major changes to the sweeping liability shield being sought by electricity providers like Arizona Public Service and Tucson Electric Power. That leaves in place significant limits the utilities want on fire victims' ability to sue utilities for damages they suffer after power lines spark forest fires. And that leaves the question of whether the legislation is constitutional. The revised proposal also tweaks rules for newly required wildfire mitigation plans that public and private electricity suppliers would have to file by eliminating what they got Representative Gail Griffin to put in her original bill, an automatic approval process. Now, utilities would get that approval 120 days after they file their plans, unless changes are requested by state regulators or the Public Utilities Board. Potentially more significant, the amendment offered by Representative Neil Carter removed a provision giving utilities sole discretion for deciding when to turn off power lines during dangerous wind events, and that, more to the point, would have prevented them from being held at fault for not de-energizing their lines. Carter is a Santan Valley Republican, but the House narrowly rejected a second amendment from Representative Alex Colladin, R. Scottsdale, that would have restored the current rules for lawsuits. He and the others argue that the major lawsuit limits that remain in the bill run afoul of the state constitution's ban on laws removing the right to sue or limiting damages. The changes became necessary to get the votes for approval. What's behind the bill is concerns by APS, TEP, Unisource, and the other utilities that they could suffer the same fate as major power suppliers in California and Oregon, which faced huge financial hits from lawsuits after entire communities were wiped out by fires started by their equipment. Although the revised proposal again allows class action lawsuits, it still provides huge new liability protections for utilities. It requires anyone seeking to hold a power company liable for damages to provide clear and convincing evidence that the utility was at fault. That is far greater and harder to prove than the standard for deciding most civil cases. Under the current standard for almost all lawsuits, jurors weigh the preponderance of the evidence, essentially whether it is more likely than not that the person did the act. It also prevents businesses and homeowners from recovering extra compensation for things like lost income or expenses incurred as a result of a fire. And it rejects any punitive damage awards, awards made to punish and deter intentional behavior, even if the utility ignores its own plans and fails to shut off power during a major wind event. Colladin said that's unconstitutional, and worse, will leave injured homeowners on the hook for losses caused by utilities. I appreciate the work that Representative Carter tried to do with the amendment, Colladin said during Tuesday's vote, but he said it is a little more than rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, because the outcome for Arizonians would be the same. The functional result of the bill, even as amended, is that even if utilities cause fires that harm our state's children, God forbid, kill some of our state's children, those families will not be able to receive compensation, Colladin said. And because the utility companies will know that, they have less incentive to stop those tragedies from occurring in the first place. He said that's why those who crafted Arizona's constitution put in its provisions barring laws that prevent negligence lawsuits and limits on recovery. Carter, an attorney like Colladin, said he believes the measure is constitutional, and he said there's plenty of good reasons to back the new limits on lawsuits, which he said still allow people to sue power companies if they have strong proof they are responsible. What it does do is it changes the evidentiary standard from negligence to what we lawyers call clear and convincing evidence, Carter said. Effectively, it means that you have to provide evidence that the power company was at fault. And he said losses from lawsuits will drive up rates for all Arizonians. Other Republicans who voted against the measure included Representative Rachel Keschel of Tucson, who said that while Carter's changes made the bill better, I am a staunch constitutionalist, and there are still issues that could have been fixed regarding the constitutionality of this. Griffin again noted that her bill had broad support from elected officials across Arizona, and wrote a long list of them who back it. This is a good bill for fire prevention, and it does cover if the utility is liable, is at fault, they are liable, Griffin had said on Monday. It now heads to the Senate for consideration. Insurance companies and trial lawyers oppose the measure, which they say will not only limit the ability of homeowners, businesses, and cities and towns to recover their losses from utilities, but could also force insurances to either greatly raise rates or stop issuing policies altogether in fire-prone areas. And that was the article. Measure would protect power companies from wildfire lawsuits. That's all the time we have for the Arizona Daily Sun. For Sun Sounds of Arizona and Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Julia. Thanks for listening.